all, this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
All right. Hey, everybody. We're back for another week of Y'allitics. We're releasing this one a little bit early.
Yeah.
Because
you have two tall boys to drink over there. That's the reason, I think, right?
Well, I think we're going to need them for this week that's coming up. Of course, the big impeachment trial of suspended Attorney General Ken Paxton is happening in Austin starting September 5th. And that's what this episode is all about. I've been waiting. We do have two large beers here today. These are 20-ounce beers. We usually, I guess, do a 12-ounce.
I think so.
What is it?
No, do you have brown bags for those?
Actually, these are 16 ounces. We usually do a 12-ounce.
Pull them on camera here.
I can't show you what
I'll show them like this. Put them right over there.
So these, I've been waiting for a long time. It's just that you never show up to work.
And
so,
I don't.
Yeah, so I've had these for a little bit because I went to Alaska in August, and
I'm the guy that never shows up to work. And then you segue into I went to Alaska. Go ahead.
That didn't
really work out.
So I went to Alaska in August. And first of all, you know, when people find out that you're from Texas in Alaska, they say, that's a cute little state, you know, because Alaska's huge. And you don't really get a perspective for how huge Alaska is until they tell you. And I haven't researched this, admittedly, because I'm always behind. But they say that in the early days in Alaska, they even like had this official thing where they, you know, were going to split the state in two.
Really?
And this was like an official proposal, they told me, so that, and I don't know if this is just an old wives' tale, they said they were going to split it in two so as not to offend Texas when they were joining the union. The problem is if they split the state in exactly two, Texas would no longer be the second largest state. It would become the third largest.
Interesting.
That's how big Alaska is.
Yeah.
That's tremendous.
Is that true?
I've
never heard of that.
That's what they told me. And multiple people told me that.
Interesting.
You would think I could have researched that before we got onto the podcast. It's been a busy time.
Yeah. I mean,
because you're never here and I'm doing twice the work.
except when you're in Alaska. But go ahead. You brought this back. Go ahead.
So I went to a place called the 49th State Brewing Company there in Anchorage. They have tons of beers to choose from. The place is legendary there. And I picked up a couple. And the one I chose, you know, sometimes I have a sweet tooth, and my favorite there when I was in Alaska was that Double Shovel pineapple. You know how I like those fruity beers.
Yeah, you do.
This one, though, says that it's brewed with, I don't even know how to pronounce this, speculoos cookies, buckets of maple syrup, and a secret blend of spices. It's called the Cabin Fever.
It'll keep you warm.
So I'm going to have a little bit of that today.
But this is a taste test, you said,
it is,
right?
Because, you know, I know that you're going to complain about this. No matter what I do, you're never happy. So this one, I looked for something for you since you're always complaining about fruity beers. And I thought, what is the least fruity beer here?
Was it a Pilsner?
And it turns out it is the Thunder Shuck. And I didn't mispronounce that. The Thunder Shuck Alaska Oyster Stout.
Oyster stout?
They actually brew this with more than two bushels, it says, of Alaskan oysters, and it also has hints of chocolate in there. This is going to be a weird drink.
You're saying O-Y-S-T-E-R.
Oyster. That's why they call it Thunder Shuck instead of Struck.
Wow.
So
I don't know if I want to try this.
Drink up on that, big bad boy. You've got 16 ounces of good old oyster beer. And they say it's got a great mouthfeel. You can imagine, like creamy from the oysters, maybe.
Dude.
No, I'm going to actually taste that one. I do like stouts. Yeah. We'll see how this goes.
This is a stout. Alaska Oyster Stout.
So a lot of times.
Let me show this right here, too.
Like when I tried the pineapple beer there, I came back to Texas and thought, do we have an analog of that here? Because I really liked it. And I found one with Austin East Ciders. Is that right? East Cider? Yeah.
C-I-D-E-R.
And I found one there. I don't think I'm going to find a Texas beer that's brewed with Texas oysters. I think it's highly unlikely.
I want you to see this as I pour this. It's like coffee.
I was going to say tar.
Gosh.
Oh, that's great. Or molasses.
Yeah.
Someone's going to have molasses.
This thing is.
That's got a good mouthfeel. As they say. I like this.
This is a family audience, man. Come on.
That's really good.
Is that what they say?
Yeah. Now you've got to.
It looks like an espresso.
You poured a big one there. Yeah. You've got to drink all of that because we've got the other one to try too. You got to try the Cabin Fever. We'll try that in between guests.
See, I don't get any hints of oysters in this.
I think it's the mouthfeel. I think that they add a little creaminess, a little earthiness, you know, unctuousness.
You would know.
Yeah. So
so let's see the other one here. What is this?
Well, let's do that one between guests because we got to finish off this stout that's in our cups
My
here.
My goodness. Thing
we're lightweight.
Drinking out of coffee cups for something that looks like coffee.
And I've eaten five Cold minutes brew. Here talking about oyster beers.
It's unlike you. Land the plane, Wheeler. Land the
okay,
plane.
Okay, so, you know.
What's this podcast
figured,
about again?
I figured we just needed a little something extra to take the edge off this week because this is going to be, it's historic
right.
just because we don't often see impeachments of high officials in Texas. I mean, this will be the third one in our history. I think it's going to be even wilder probably. They probably thought the last two were the wildest of their time. I think this one's going to be wilder than that.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Well, the last one, the last statewide official, which was the governor in 1920, something mm-hmm. like that.
Mm-hmm. Ferguson.
Paul Ferguson. And there was allegations of corruption there, too, which I think you're right. It was probably the trial of the century at that time. Fast forward a century, and here we are again. So much has happened leading up to this.
Mm-hmm.
Will Ken Paxton testify?
Mm-hmm.
Will he resign? There's been a lot of chatter, and I haven't reported any of this, but I've heard a lot of chatter about, oh, he's going to resign.
Mm-hmm.
He comes out on X or on Twitter the other day and says, wrong.
Yeah.
I will never stop fighting for conservatives and conservative values in this state. A contact of mine said, you know, what was interesting about his statement there was he didn't say he was not going to resign. He just said, wrong. I'm going to continue fighting for conservative values.
That is interesting.
He said, read between the lines here.
So it's not a full denial.
Not a full denial.
Not straight on.
It still leaves him an opportunity if things were to go south, if he wanted to do that.
Or if they try to compel him to testify.
Right. But he could plead the fifth if he was
He could, but if you plead the fifth, you know, aren't you acknowledging that you might have some legal exposure that you might have done something wrong?
Or you're not talking about it.
Yeah.
I like to plead the fifth with you a lot, but, you know, you still
Well, you've
out.
Probably done a lot of things wrong. So, you know, he's also got, you know, the specter of criminal cases
right.
hanging over this. And so, you know, understandably, you'd be nervous about getting up there and getting
right.
under oath because that can be used against you in those courts of law as well subsequently.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, the public can watch this in person in the Senate gallery.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be there, you know, watching as well. People can watch it online. I want to know how many people are in the Senate gallery with yellow legal pads.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Taking notes on this for these cases outside of the Senate.
Those are the other attorneys. Those are the prosecutors that I would bet. They're probably going to watch the live stream of this. So.
Yeah.
But anyways, I mean, there's going to be a lot of stuff that comes out.
There is. And it's ugly even before it starts. I mean, it's been ugly from the beginning.
Right.
But, boy, the back and forth. And you know, it's interesting because I've seen some of these ads. I mean, there have been ads.
Billboards,
they're taking
too,
the
yeah.
airwaves on this. Especially on the, you know, the Protect Paxton, the pro-Paxton side, and basically saying, you know, it's the left, it's the liberals, you know, trying
Rhinos.
To defeat him because he's been strong on the border and strong on abortion and you know, strong on, you know, fighting the Biden administration. This is not the left, though. I mean, this is
right.
this has become an intra-party struggle with Republicans. On one side, you've got those who are saying, you know, we got to draw this line. It's gone too far. We got to do something about this. On the other side, you know, it's being called, you know, a witch hunt. This is all made up. This is all for political purposes. They're just trying to damage him. Some of them want to run for his seat.
Yeah.
And so it's getting nasty before it even begins.
And that's the politics behind it. The people with political ambition who are in the Senate. Who might want that seat. You know, he's had a seat locked up,
mm-hmm.
just like Abbott's had the governorship locked up, and Lieutenant Governor's had, Patrick's had that locked up for what, 12?
Long time.
14 years now, it seems like.
Yeah.
It's a long time. People are waiting in the wings. There are a number of people who would like to run for one of those top three seats.
Well, but, you know, in the last election, we saw several, you know, brand name,
people,
you
yeah.
know, or name brand high profile candidates running for Ken Paxton's seat on the Republican side. And they couldn't do it. They couldn't
right.
get past him. He is popular with a segment of conservatives in Texas who vote. They show up
yeah.
and they show up every time. And so, you know, that is the question. You know, can anybody take him out, you know, in an election? And if they take him out with a conviction in a an impeachment trial, will, you know, they suffer the consequences right. the next time we get to a primary? You know,
and those threats have already happened.
You know that that's on the minds yeah. of a lot of these senators.
And to get back to what you just said a moment ago about how it's dividing the Republican Party of Texas, I wonder. Republicans vote in unity more than Democrats, much more than Democrats, and they show up, at least in this state, much more than Democrats to go vote. I wonder, though, at the end of this, how divided is the Republican Party of Texas going into 2024? Mm. If it looks like Trump's going to be the Republican nominee for president, what does that look like? Mm.
And we're going to get into that with our second guest
right.
today. And I think he's going to have some really interesting predictions about what could happen here, either way this goes, and how that could affect Republicans in this state
Good
come 2024. First, though, we've got to get to this precinct chair in Collin County. This is where it all started for Ken Paxton, where his political career started
yep.
in Collin County. And there's a GOP precinct chair there who's going out on a limb here.
Speaking of division...
Yeah.
David Leith is this guy's name. He sends me an email the other day and says, listen, Paxton and Senator Paxton, General Paxton and Senator Paxton have huge support in Collin County. But there are a few of us, himself included, who think that let the process play itself out. Mm. The process needs to play itself out.
Because Paxton just wants this stuff dismissed and thrown out.
And his supporters do as well.
Yeah.
Say, you know, let's move on with it. They called it a kangaroo court. It's a sham. And, you know, back to the liberals, back to rhinos who brought these charges just because he says that he's been fighting for conservative values. So David Leith is on the ground. A precinct chair, if you don't know what a precinct chair does, mm. these are the most grassroots of any political party. They're the ones who... physically get the vote out. They go out and find candidates to run for different seats. So David Leith sends me an email, and I asked him, said, hey, give me a couple other people in addition to yourself I'd like to talk to. Well, I called the other people.
And these are supposed to be pro-Paxton.
Pro-Paxton people. Yeah. And one of them wrote me back on email. I didn't call them. I emailed them first. And one of them wrote me back, and I said, listen, we'd like to do this interview with you to get your point of view on this. She never wrote me back a second time.
Crickets.
Same thing with the second person that he suggested. She didn't even respond at all. Now, maybe my email shows up in people's junk mailboxes. I don't know. I know you wish it would for yours.
It does in mine, but it just goes straight to delete if it gets into my inbox.
But David answered the call, and this is a pretty good conversation with somebody who's really on the ground of Republican politics in Collin County.
Yeah, it's not real long, but he gets to the point.
Hey, y'all. This is where Texas politics gets interesting. For another smart conversation on Eolitics.
David, thanks so much for joining us here from Collin County, no less. This, of course, is ground zero in the Paxton family. That's where his political career started there in Collin County when he went to the legislature. And it's where his wife still represents you all in the state Senate. So, you know, you're a GOP precinct chair there in Collin County.
Correct.
What are your thoughts about Ken Paxton and this trial that's going to happen in the Senate? You're saying, you know, this needs to happen and needs to be aired out.
Yes, I'm a minority. I'll be fair about this. My situation here is I'm an engineer, quality control. I look at things. I read things. Facts matter. Issues matter. And I was a big proponent. As soon as I heard about it, first thing I did is read the original documents. And from my opinion, we've got to investigate this. We've got to put it to bed. Ken Paxton has got to have the opportunity to explain his point of view. And to the prosecution, Senate, needs the opportunity to work through the system. Ken's got to have the opportunity to prove that he's innocent, or they got to prove that he's guilty. And he's got to have the opportunity to say his position. That's vital. So this is not going to go away unless it runs through the course. So,
David, let me ask you this. You said that you're in the minority inside the Collin County GOP. What have your colleagues been telling you? Because you and I first started talking, you mentioned a couple of other people who would be willing to speak with us possibly, and they have different views than you.
Absolutely. And that's a good thing about it. I mean, that's how the GOP operates. People are allowed to say their piece, and we vote and we move on. So But to be very blunt with my position, I was very much favored moving forward. Some people wanted to, you know, run people against our local reps who voted for the impeachment to move through, and they can do whatever they want to. My personal thing is Ken Paxton should resign today, focus his efforts on winning the next election and dealing with the SEC. And also he needs to put this to bed by, you know, giving Texas back the $3.3 million, whatever it ends up being, out of his own pocket. Ken Paxton has been very vocal about saying, I'm going to quote it here. I've got it on my screen here. "Wrong, I will never stop fighting for the people of Texas and defending our conservative values." When you think about that, all sorts of logical fallacies in there, because really his actions were firing whistleblowers. He is an attorney general. He knows you don't do that. You have got to have a great reason. And this whole thing came down with him trying to settle with them. And there were words even there about how much will it cost if I don't have to admit that I was, if I don't have to apologize. Mm-hmm. And so this Texas has got to eat this money. He wants Texas to eat the money. I'm sorry, but unless Ken Paxton reimburses the state of Texas for what his actions cost us, then he's dead to me. I'm sorry,
David.
It's that simple.
There are a lot of Republicans who say that that very kind of thinking is rhino thinking, that Speaker Dade Phelan in the House of Representatives and the GOP reps over there who voted to impeach him, who have the same line of view that you have, that those guys aren't real Republicans.
Real Republican is not, you know, embracing ignorance. A true Republican wants everybody to say their piece, let the chips fall where they lie. If you did something wrong, I'm not saying he did. That's why we move forward. I'm not saying he's innocent either. I'm not saying anything about that. It's simply that if you screw up, you take one for the team and you do what is right. What is right is reimbursing taxpayers for all the money that his actions and his actions alone on this settlement cost us. That's something that's not even up for debate.
David, as a precinct chair there in Collin County, precinct chairs are very close to the grassroots, very close to the electorate. Yeah, you're interacting with people all the time. You're interacting with, you know, potential candidates for the Republican Party down the road. I'm curious, when you say these things, I don't know how often you've said them or how loudly you've said them.
I've said it loudly.
Okay. Even before this. So what kind of feedback are you getting from people?
Well, in my precinct, we are 50-50. You know, we are minority majority. We're a solid mix of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. So we are purple for all there. So my job is what's best for the people in my precinct. And we are very much on the same page that this needs to play out. No one is above the law, to use all these other expressions, tired expressions that everybody says. But the bottom line here is there is something here. And Ken Paxton has the opportunity to make it right and explain his position.
Have you been confronted, though?
It should be done.
Have you been confronted, though, by other Republicans because of your beliefs on this?
Oh, yeah, I have. But I wouldn't say as much as confrontation is we don't agree. And, you know, there are things that people don't agree with on all the time. But we all get the right to speak and to express our position. And that's good. We are all friends. And, you know, where Rhino gets thrown out there, if you know, kind of a knee-jerk reaction, but I don't care.
David, last question I have for you. You've seen all the news coverage, and you probably read a lot of it yourself, but the House prosecutors released almost 4,000 pages of documents that they say they plan to use as evidence in trying to get Paxton convicted and removed from office. Which way do you think this is going to swing with all this stuff coming out here as we close in on the opening of the trial?
Well, first of all, I read almost all of it, actually. So it comes down to, look, he only needs 11 votes. out of 19 Republicans, and it goes away. So statistically, if you look at that, I personally don't see this thing. I see this whole thing being dismissed, maybe even the same day it starts up. Because the votes just aren't there. Ken Paxton is very powerful politically. He's done some wonderful things for his state. And also Angela. I mean, she's fantastic. We have weekly, Zoom sessions with people, in Collin County, and she's wonderful. I'm sad that she's dragged into this. And we don't need to get into the personal, what happened there. Everybody knows, but anyway. But it just needs to be put to bed. And that's the bottom line. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but if I had to go to Vegas and lay money on it, then, yeah, I'd say the Senate's not going to be able to prove their case, and he's going to be acquitted of everything.
David, let's say that we get into this, though, and it doesn't turn out that way. Let's say that you watch this trial, and you think that an incredibly strong case is put forward, and you think that it is as obvious as day how this should go. And let's say that you think that, the suspended attorney general should be convicted and removed from office and kept from running again here in this state. But it doesn't go that way. Let's say the vote doesn't go that way among these senators who will act as jurors. Would that shake your faith in your party?
My faith in the party will never be shaken. Bottom line. I mean, there's ups and downs. We have disagreement. The system said he can be impeached. The system said he's acquitted. QED, he had his opportunity. And if the Republican Party at the, county level and at the state level, if Ken Paxton is our candidate for the general election, I'm backing him 100%. That goes with the oath I took.
So with that said, then, what incentive does a Republican senator have at this point to do this? If you say that, and let's say if there are lots of other Republicans in this state who really feel strongly, let's say during the trial, that Ken Paxton is as guilty as sin, but all of the senators on the Republican side decide to go ahead and give him a pass and leave him in office, what is their incentive to take that hard to take stand if they know that they can still be elected and that the party remains in power and no one loses?
Using a wide net there. Guilty of sin, let's not forget that some of the articles of impeachment are he had an affair. Why that is even there, I don't know. So, I'm sorry. I don't care if he had an affair.
Taking that out of it, though, bribery and things like that.
Guilty. Ask me about something very specific. I'll give you a specific answer.
Okay. So if you were to see a strong case and you felt like, wow, there's evidence here of bribery and misuse of office and corruption in office, a lot of senators, decided to go ahead and leave him there. If that doesn't make you lose your faith and it doesn't make others lose their faith, this is a tough vote for Republican senators to have to take. They're being pulled in both directions. Why would they take a tough stand if enough people out there would say, well, I'm not going to lose faith in them, even if they do what I don't think they should here?
That's why I want him to give us that $3.5 million, whatever it is, because you take that off the table and Ken Paxton ponies up to that, then it's all really the whole thing comes down to having Texas pick up the bill for, firing the whistleblowers, allegedly. If he pays that out of his own pocket, then I can't imagine anyone saying, okay, he made up for it. Texas didn't take the hit. We got nothing here. So that takes it off the table. I'm not going to answer your question about, what am I going to do if this happens? Personally, I believe everybody's going to do what they think is best. And I'm going to back whoever the party nominates in the general election.
David, why do you think he should resign?
Because if he can resign, if he resigns, he can focus his attention on everything else. And if he resigns and the Senate acquits him, then he is now set up to run for governor, U.S. Senate. And his all of his options are wide open. He doesn't have a gag order on it anymore. He would have the freedom, you know, again, should he be acquitted, to do whatever he wants to in his career. And again, if he's acquitted, then he'll have my vote for governor or senator or anything else. So I think it'd be a smart move for him to resign for that reason. Plus, he can give his entire attention to, you know, the hand slapping he's probably going to get with the SEC and pay some fine and have it be done with.
David Leaf, the a GOP precinct chair in Collin County, sharing some thoughts about Ken Paxton with us. David, thank you so much for doing this with us. It's interesting to hear all viewpoints here.
Glad to be here.
Click subscribe and get Y'all-itics every week. Y'all-itics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Okay, so David Leaf says, let's do this thing. Let's not just throw it out. Let's not just disregard and cancel this trial or be done with this. Let's hear it out. And he says he's read every bit of what's come out so far, which is extraordinary if that's true.
4,000 pages.
Yeah, that's a lot of reading.
Now, some of it's an easy read, but that's a lot of material to go through, you know?
Yeah, I'm curious to see in this impeachment trial how they're going to present. It's voluminous. I mean, just when the House investigators first talked about their investigation months ago, right before Ken Paxton was impeached in the House, that hearing took 3 hours.
You and I were in it.
For them to lay out the information. In this case, they've got each side has 60 minutes to be able to do their opening statements, right, and then they get 24 total hours to be able to do their entire case. And that can be over several days,
sure,
you know, but 24 hours to present an entire case, especially when it has a lot of tentacles and a lot of people involved and a lot of witnesses, that is not an easy lift.
Yeah, 20 articles of impeachment, 16 will be, tried when he goes on trial. So watching these play out are going to be as interesting as this beer you're about to pour.
Yeah.
What is this one? So this is the second one.
Okay, so now we're, you know, hit me again, because we're getting ready for Matt Mikowiak here, who is very plugged in Republican circles here in Texas, and he's going to tell us what he's seeing going into this. And there's some interesting stuff in this. This one's called the Cabin Fever.
Yeah. Interesting stuff in Matt's interview or in this can of beer?
All the above. this is called Cabin Fever. It's from 49th State Brewing out of Alaska. As we continue our Alaska-Texas connection today,
right,
this one is also darker. Yeah. It is a sweet beer. It's going to be nothing like the oyster beer.
Alaskan beer tour here.
Oh wow, that's a holiday cookie,
that is definitely a Christmas beer.
That is definitely a holiday.
Wow,
cookie.
Wow, that'll keep you warm, man.
Oh my God.
I now see why they sell this in 16-ounce cans in Alaska.
So did I go in the right order here? Do you think?
Wow.
Should we have done the oyster beer last?
They don't have any pilsners or anything.
This is
like that?
Dessert after that.
That is,
you know.
Yeah. My goodness.
They do have pilsners up there.
Gosh.
I looked for the things that I thought might anger you the most. For me to bring back.
You put off this idea that I'm like, I'm angry and I'm bothersome to you.
You're very angry.
I don't think that at all.
I really don't.
I save you all the time.
No, I really don't. I think you're angry and bothersome in general, not just to me.
You're talking about yourself here. That's what's funny.
No, but I mean, you're kind of curmudgeon-y, you know? So it's weird. It's like there's this zero-sum game. Like, as I'm looking for beers, I think if I can find one he doesn't like, I win. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of bizarre and messed
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
Our producer is looking at us through a glass here. We're having a very holiday, sweet, like cookie-tasting beer.
So this will be like a two-hour-long podcast.
Yeah, this is going to be a long one. Look how big these cans are. They're 16 ounces. We don't usually do this. We're lightweights.
Right. We are lightweights. So let's get to it here because Matt Mikowiak.
It's too late for that. We've
I know, right?
Missed that train.
We're deep into the podcast here. Matt Mikowiak, though, is a Republican consultant. He's the chairman of the Travis County Republican Party. Mm-hmm. He's the guy we go to a lot to give us an honest take on what's going on inside conservative circles.
And this is all playing out right there in his yard.
Right where he is. So we called him up to get an idea of what he's watching for as this thing starts to unfold. Hey, Matt, good to see you again. The trial starts on Tuesday. What are you going to be watching for in these early days this week?
Yeah, so I think the first test is going to be what are the rulings on the motions to dismiss? There are a handful of them. They're taking so many different approaches to dismissing the charges. There's a motion to dismiss all of them. There's a motion to or 19 of them, I think. On the prior election doctrine, there are individual motions to get rid of them individually. And there's a question as to whether the president of the Senate, the presiding officer, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, will make those decisions entirely by himself or whether he'll have the senators vote on them. You could imagine that it would be sort of less politically fraught for him if the senators voted right. on those motions, particularly if they vote to dismiss. But there are other motions related to how the House conducted the impeachment, the way the evidence was collected, and all kinds of other questions. So it is true that the Lieutenant Governor was asked this on a Dallas radio show, I don't know, 2 months ago. And my memory is he said that he thought that this deserved the seriousness of the individual issues being considered. So he made it sound like he thought moving, agreeing to dismiss the charges was not the appropriate step. But, you know, who knows whether that would continue or whether the senators would vote that way. So to me, that's the first question. I think the second question is, what are we going to learn? You know, there's been a drip here for the last four weeks or so. Different things have come out. There's a gag order that affects the participants, but there's not a gag order on leaks and on media stories. And I'm sure that's deeply frustrating if you're the Paxton team. They can't respond. They can't defend themselves. They can't, correct things. That's got to be frustrating. That drip, I think, has been intended to try to affect two things. One, to try to put pressure on Republican senators to impeach. And then second, to try to establish that there are, quote unquote, new facts. Which would then undermine this prior election doctrine. The prior election doctrine, just for those who don't know, states that you can't impeach someone for acts that occurred in a previous election cycle on the basis that the voters had that information and decided to elect that person anyway. So that doctrine is going to get challenged. It's going to get tested. It's going to get ruled on one way or the other. And that will be important, particularly if that's part of how Paxton survives here. To me, the third question is, what kind of defense do Paxton's lawyers present? There have been, a couple pieces of information that have dribbled out, proof of a wire related to the home renovations, a couple other pieces of information over the last few months. But during the House portion of the impeachment, that operated really or functioned sort of as a grand jury. So there was really no opportunity or no real tradition for Paxton's team to be able to present evidence, to call witnesses, to respond, to testify, et cetera. So we really haven't heard a strong defense. We've heard a kind of a blanket denial by the current attorney general, I guess, the suspended attorney general, but we haven't heard a detailed defense. It'll be interesting to see. And I think that there's a chance that the needle they're going to try to thread is that, they're not going to deny some of the behavior certainly related to the affair. And they're not going to deny some of the decisions he made. What they're going to deny is that these things rise to the level of being worthy of impeachment or being criminal. And, I think the last thing to watch is to me is going, well, I guess two last things to watch. The second to last one is, will Ken Paxton be forced to testify? I was talking to a couple of people who have a lot of experience in this area in the last few weeks. Apparently, there's no evidence of any elected official, not just in Texas, but across the country, who's gone through an impeachment, who was forced to testify. Now, I don't know if that means that the ones that had to then just pled the fifth or they never had to testify at all. There's some question as to whether it's pretty clear Paxton doesn't want to testify. And actually, I think that does make some sense on one level. And that is, if he has potential criminal liability over these questions, that testimony obviously could affect, his legal situation. And so, from his standpoint, not testifying probably is the right legal decision. You know, if I were him and if I truly did not believe I did these things that were alleged, I would want to testify. Of course, he's going to get asked, a lot of unpleasant questions, things that will be embarrassing, things that will dredge up, aspects of the affair, which I'm sure have been damaging to his marriage, although it from all outside, views, it appears they have reconciled and put it behind them, which is obviously not easy to do. So that defense that the Paxton team puts forward, the witnesses they call, the cross-examination, the facts they try to introduce, to me is going to be very interesting. And then finally, it's just the vote, right? I mean, obviously the vote is what's going to matter here. And so You have 16 individual articles of impeachment that are going to be considered initially. 15 of them occurred in the previous election cycle. The last one relates to the whistleblower agreement. I think it'd be very hard to impeach on the whistleblower agreement. Texas Whistleblower Act prevents the state elected officials from having to pay personally. And in this case, I do think it's reasonable to conclude that the Attorney General's office was aiming to put the litigation behind the state and to save the state money. It will cost the state far more money than $3.3 million to take this to trial all the way through. But then there's four charges related to the securities fraud allegations, which are now before a court in Houston are starting to make maybe finally some slow progress after 8 or 9 years of really kind of hanging in the air. But keep in mind, it takes a 2/3 vote to impeach him on any of these individual articles. If they do, Jason, if he is not impeached on 15 of them and he's impeached on one of them, my understanding is that he is removed from office. It would then be a separate vote to determine if he can never hold state office again. That, of course, does not affect federal office. And we will have, I think, a U.S. Senate, open U.S. Senate seat in 2026. I don't expect Senator Cornyn to run for election, although you never know, and he hasn't made an announcement. Some of these folks want to maybe run for attorney general. Some of them want to run for lieutenant governor and not have to run against Ken Paxton. Some of them don't like Ken for whatever reason. Some of them do like him. Some of them want, you know, obviously want to maintain a good relationship with his wife, Angela, who's in the Senate. I mean, there are so many complicating variables here. In the end, I think the evidence will probably lead senators to the decision that they think is right.
You mentioned some of the money that's being spent for the influence campaign from a side that has decided, you know, that, you know, maybe it's best for the suspended attorney general to go. There's money being spent on the other side as well, though. We've seen some texting campaigns. Former Governor Rick Perry referred to this in his op-ed, these, you know, texting campaigns, these influence campaigns. From where you are, you're plugged in, you talk to these people. How strong is the pressure right now on these senators? How much are they hearing from donors? How much are they, you know, worried about a potential primary if they vote this way or that way? How much pressure is being applied?
Yeah, I mean, I think to really explain the dynamic, what you have, if you kind of oversimplify it as you have, I think the grassroots has generally continued to stick with Paxton over the allegations, over the challenges. It's obviously not true of every single individual, but I think most of the Republican grassroots sees him as a fighter, as a strong conservative, as a Trump ally, as someone who's done a good job as attorney general. Certainly most donors and perhaps business leaders and to some extent elected officials think that maybe that the right decision is for him to either resign or to be impeached. So there's a sort of a donor grassroots split. Now, to your question, which I do think is important, you have half the Senate as of now that is up for re-election in 2024. There is a possibility that all 31 senators will have to run if the map changes because of existing challenges to the map. You could have a scenario where all 31 have to run again. Wow. We will know that here in the next, you know, 3 or 4 months, I suspect, as we get closer to a filing period. What we know right now is that the Paxton impeachment is going to be an issue in a dozen or two dozen House primaries. When I say an issue, I mean people running with that being a major part of their campaign, with funding coming on that issue, with that being a very clear dividing line. Right now, because the Senate hasn't taken a position, no senator is really facing that. That could change if you have a certain number of Republicans who are in cycle. Vote that way, you could have them face conservative challengers on that issue. So I do think the pressure is increasing. There's no question. There's a handful of senators that I think are more interesting to watch than others, given their perspective, given their position, given their relationships, given what they may want to do in the future politically.
Who is that, Matt? Who should we be watching for? Which senators?
Yeah, I think that the two that are the most interesting are Mays Middleton, who's a fairly new member of the Senate, very personally wealthy from oil and gas, served in the House, has been a pretty hardline but pretty effective senator. He personally put $300,000 behind Louie Gohmert, who was one of the four people that ran for attorney general in the primary. That came together very late. I don't think that was necessarily because Senator Middleton believes Louie Gohmert is the best person to be attorney general of Texas. I think at that time, that was intended to try to force a primary runoff. on the belief that that would give more time for things to come out and things to happen and develop to perhaps weaken Paxton in the primary runoff. There was a primary runoff. George P. Bush got in there, and I think Paxton won something like 60-40 or 62-38. And Middleton, I think, is very ambitious. You know, there's been chatter that he very well may run for lieutenant governor if Dan Patrick doesn't run for re-election in 2026. There's also been chatter that if Ken Paxton is the AG, that he may run for lieutenant governor. So I think that that is one thing to watch. Obviously, you would hope that, and I'm not saying this just about Senator Middleton, that no senator would make a decision on something as important as this, as historic as this, based on trying to eliminate a future competitor in a primary for a statewide office. But these are human beings, and they're very ambitious, and so that could be a factor, could be something you could consider deep in the recesses of your mind. I think the second person to watch is Joan Huffman, who I think has been discussed as a potential candidate for Attorney General in the future. She has a lot of experience working on those issues in the Senate. She's been highly effective. Could that potentially be a factor for her? Who knows? But look, all these senators are interesting in their own way. You could look at someone like maybe Charles Perry or Drew Springer, who are from rural areas, Northeast Texas and West Texas. I imagine that their constituents would be probably pretty strongly opposing impeachment. How much of this is a senator making the decision because they think it's the right decision versus how much of it is them trying to represent their constituency? It's a question that only they can answer, and it's a conclusion they can only come to themselves individually.
That's what I was going to ask you. You know, for people who think that maybe, you know, we'll see justice done here. You know, this is a trial. It's happening in the Senate, but it's a trial. But is it possible truly to get justice here? I mean, these senators are jurors. You don't usually hear in a trial about jurors being lobbied and about jurors worried about keeping their jobs depending on which way they decide a case. Is it possible to have justice in that environment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And look, this is a fundamentally political exercise. I mean, we have to all be very honest about the fact that this is not a courtroom. This is not something that has criminal liability. He's not going to jail based on how the Senate votes. It is a political exercise. Impeachment is a fundamentally political exercise. I think that was true no matter what your view was on the Trump impeachments. That was a political exercise as well. And part of, I think, how you know it's political is I will wager, an obscene amount of money that every single Democrat in the Texas Senate votes to impeach. And whether you want to say they've concluded that already or they're just all going to be on that side wearing a blue jersey, I would be shocked. I mean, knock me over with a feather, shocked if they didn't vote that way. I do think, I should add, there's another person to watch here that's very interesting, and that's John Whitmire. Who is a sitting senator from Houston, one of the longest serving members of the Senate, has a huge war chest of, I say, $10 or $11 million, and now is one of the top two leading candidates for mayor of Houston. He has attracted a lot of business and even in some cases GOP donor support on the belief that he would be a more pro-law enforcement mayor than the other leading contender, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who's more progressive. This puts him in an interesting position. He's generally been somewhat aligned with the lieutenant governor. I doubt he's all that close with the attorney general, but it puts him in a little bit of a position. If he somehow were to not vote with all the Democrats, I assure you that would become an issue in the mayor's race. I do expect him, not with any knowledge, I do expect him to vote to impeach, and all those Democrats will come together. But to your question, it's totally different, right? Jurors' identities are kept secret, or they certainly should be. They're supposed to report to a judge if they have any outside influence placed upon them or feel any pressure. They're not even supposed to watch the news about a specific case. They're generally instructed not to do that. No one has instructed the senators not to watch the news, not to look at text messages, not to hear from constituents. So it's a totally different kind of exercise.
And Matt, Paxton believes he's done nothing wrong here. And the one question I just can't figure out in all this, looking at the drip, drip, drip of evidence, hearing both sides, is what in the world do you think Ken Paxton saw in Nate Paul?
Yeah, so I fundamentally do not believe this was an issue of a donor of the Attorney General trying to repay a favor or give a benefit to a donor. Ken Paxton probably has 200 or 300 or 400 people who have given $25,000
sure
at any time while he's been Attorney General of Texas to his campaign, which is what Nate Paul gave. In the grand scheme of things, he is not in the top 100 donors or 200 donors to Ken Paxton. If you were going to, you know, help everyone that gave you $25,000 as Attorney General of Texas, you would be doing favors nonstop.
Right.
Right. So I've never believed that that was the motivator. What I can tell you is, look, he clearly should have had better judgment about Nate Paul. And you know, Nate has obviously is facing very serious problems right now. But you know, there was chatter and I think doubt about his business empire, how quickly he emerged as a major player, really kind of out of nowhere, and the way he was operating, his flashy lifestyle. So I do think he probably showed some poor judgment there and perhaps, you know, trusting Nate Paul's word as much as he did. That said, what I can tell you is, and this is what I was talking about the defense. It'll be interesting to see whether the Paxton team is able to show and demonstrate why Nate Paul believed he was being treated so unfairly. My understanding is that there was no active warrant when Nate Paul's home and office were raided, that was backdated after the fact. Now, the question is it appropriate for the attorney general to hire an outside lawyer to try to help, you know, that individual who feels they've been wrong? Is it appropriate for the attorney general to set up a meeting with the DA so they can hear out Nate Paul's concerns? I don't think setting up a meeting with another official is a benefit that would only happen for a donor. I think a business leader that may have supported another candidate against Ken Paxton, if they were in the same circumstance, I suspect he would do the same thing. The outside lawyer and all of that is a different question. But to answer your question, did he show some perhaps poor judgment in sort of aligning with and trusting Nate Paul the way he did early on? I think that's right. And I think deep down, he probably would admit that. That doesn't answer the question as to whether Nate Paul was being treated fairly throughout the process. And I just don't know the answer. But what I can tell you is if they can prove there was no warrant, no active warrant, you know, that may be an important fact for senators that may explain why the attorney general is taking the steps that he took. And so, you know, that's just, I think, you know, an interesting aspect of this that may come out.
Even if he wasn't doing it, though, to help someone who had donated money to him, let's say if you're in that position and you do something to help out a good friend, you just want to help out a good friend. It doesn't have to do with them being a donor to you as well, which does complicate things. Yeah. You know, even if you make a mistake in judgment like that, that can lead to crimes. That can lead to, you know, abuse of office. It can lead to corruption. It can lead to bribery in its own right. These are serious allegations that are being put out there. We know that there's cases moving forward in the criminal realm affecting the suspended attorney general. How much liability do Republicans feel here if, okay, let's say we go through this trial, the public sees all of this evidence, they hear all of this evidence, which, you know, as you've mentioned over the last month, as we've seen this drip, it has looked damning because, you know, obviously we're only hearing one side of this. But what if we go through this whole trial and you know, the public hears all of this strong evidence, and then, you know, he gets off, he maintains his position, but then one of those criminal cases pops, you know, and don't Republicans then look like they let him off the hook, and then the criminal justice system came along and did, you know, the work that they didn't do? Is there a worry about that from the Republican side?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And it could look bad if they choose to not impeach him. And then afterwards, he gets convicted criminally, either federally or at some other level. I guess the DOJ has basically taken this case over, so it probably would be federal where he'd be dealing with it. You know, again, I do think that the process, the rules of evidence, all of that are different in this case than they would be in a criminal matter. And so I think there may be some differences there. And look, I think there's an open question as to whether it's one thing to set up a meeting. It's another to have an outside lawyer look into the allegations that Nate Paul was raising. It's a whole another one to have him start doing favors for you. If there are favors related, you know, to home renovations or having your mistress, you know, get a job or this stuff with Uber or whatever else. Obviously, that gets into a category that should give almost anyone who would serve in a quote unquote juror role concern and pause. But I don't know whether senators are going to be looking at this through the lens of sort of history and being on the quote unquote right side of history and being proven that their decision was the correct one, you know, a year or two from now when this gets adjudicated criminally. My guess is they're just going to try to make the best decision they can in the moment based on the facts they have, based on the way it's conducted, based on the fact that this is fundamentally political to some extent. So, you know, there's some different angles to this for them to consider, and they're all going to have their own way of evaluating this.
Matt, we've seen the House prosecutors release the 4,000 pages of evidence. We've seen Texans for Lawsuit Reform come out, a conservative group, and be in opposition to Paxton. Rick Perry, of course, wrote the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. What does your gut say right now? Which way is this thing going to go? Earlier, when we spoke a few weeks back, you thought Kim Paxton likely survives this. A lot has changed on the ground since then. Does Kim Paxton survive this trial?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to predict right now because there's so many variables that still have to get assessed and ruled on, right? If I knew whether the motion to dismiss was voted on and what that vote looked like, that's a test vote, right? If no Republican votes to in favor of the motion to dismiss, that's one thing. If there's a split vote, that may give you an idea of you know, where the votes might be at the end, right? What I will say is I do think two months ago, I thought he was likely to survive this. I do think that the odds of that have decreased. You know, I thought maybe there was a 70% chance he'd survive this a couple months ago. I think it's probably 50-50 or maybe slightly below 50-50 even right now. But again, without knowing what the defense is going to present, without knowing how the exact rules are going to be enforced, without knowing how the motion to dismiss is going to go, without knowing whether he's going to testify or have to testify, be forced to testify. These are huge questions, right? That if they go one way or the other, it truly affects the way things will go. I do think the last month has been bad for Paxton's team, and that may or may not be his fault. This gag order is a serious one, and it does limit what he can do. Perhaps he needed allies out there pushing more, perhaps even publicly, the way that the other side has been, because clearly this is being worked out in the sort of court of public opinion as a pressure campaign in both directions. But right now, I think senators are under more pressure to impeach than they are to not impeach. Whether the grassroots gets organized and starts to apply pressure, to me, is a big question here in the next week to 10 days. But I think we're going to know pretty early on how this thing begins to unfold.
Matt, if he does survive this impeachment trial and maintains his office, does Ken Paxton then become sort of the most powerful politician in Austin? And what does this do to the party if he survives? Does he go on a revenge tour? Does this deepen this chasm that we've been seeing in the Texas Republican Party? Because there is a chasm there. What happens if he survives to him and to the party?
Yeah, I don't think he gains power. He may gain some status and some profile and you know, maybe among sort of Trump voters, he may be seen as a even more of a fighter. But you know, his problems aren't over if he survives this. I mean, you still have the other four charges that have to get dispensed with for him not to be suspended. These are the four charges related to the criminal securities fraud allegations. You have two challenges before the state bar to try to disbar him. I think both of them are ridiculous, but who knows how the state bar will ultimately rule. You have a grand jury in San Antonio that's been meeting. Presumably they'll be indicting him at some point here. I would tend to think that that's more than a 50-50 scenario. So I guess the point is, you know, his problems are not over. And of course he still has the securities fraud trial to go forward, right? So even if he survives this, he's going to have a lot of other problems. Now for the party, I do think this will be divisive. I actually think it's divisive either way. If they don't impeach him, there becomes an even bigger split between the House leadership and the Senate leadership. If they do impeach him, the senators, Republican senators that vote for that are going to put them at risk of a primary either now or next time, particularly now, those who are in cycle now. And that might be something to watch for. Perhaps the senators who are up 2 years from now might be more likely to vote to impeach, and the ones who are up this next year might be less likely to impeach. That might be something to watch. But this is the Paxton stuff and the fight over how conservative the House is and whether, quote unquote, Democrats run the House. That's going to be a huge issue in the primaries. Exactly how many districts that truly affects remains to be seen. The question is the Senate going to be part of that battle or not? And I think that'll be a consequence or a result of the decision the Senate makes.
But even if that makes the chasm deeper in the Republican Party, that doesn't necessarily imperil them as far as being able to control state government, does it? Or does it?
Well, I mean, the question becomes, will Republicans unify after the primaries and primary runoffs? And then how does that affect the presidential election cycle here in November of 2024? You know, if Trump were the nominee and he's at the top of the ticket, we've saw him win Texas by 9% 8 years ago and 6% 4 years ago, right? If that trajectory continues and it's a 3% margin, which I'm not predicting, but if that is what happens, you're going to have a hell of a lot of seats that are going to be very, very competitive in November of 2024. And so,
if some Republicans stay home because there's bad blood because of this Paxton impeachment, that could be especially costly, couldn't it?
That's right. And look, there's maybe one of the 31 Senate seats that could be competitive in November of 2024. The House is different. I mean, there's a dozen House seats, maybe 15, that could be competitive, where a 5% undervote of Republican voters could be the difference. So yeah, this is going to be divisive for the Republican Party. There's no question. And it's a very complicated matter. There's no rule book for this. This is almost unprecedented, certainly in the modern era. But it's obviously an important matter for the Senate to take seriously. And I think they will.
And it's about to get going. Matt, always appreciate your insight, man. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thank y'all.
Thank you, Matt.
Okay, y'all. The conversation doesn't stop here. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Yolitics.
So that's a lot.
It's a lot of context.
It is. And you know, keep all of this stuff in mind, all of these little nuggets that he just got to, that both of them just got to, as the trial unfolds there in the Texas Senate.
Big question is, how long is it going to last? Lieutenant Governor Patrick said 2.5 to 3 weeks. Roland Gutierrez says to my friend Ryan Chandler the other day that it's going to go 4 to 6 weeks.
Jeez.
Can you imagine 4 to 6 weeks? I don't see how that's going to happen.
I can't wait to see what the viewership is on this.
on this podcast
especially if it drags that long, though.
If you are still listening this far into the podcast, we appreciate that.
Congrats.
Wheeler went on forever about his Alaskan beer and how I'm always gone, but he's in Alaska.
I've held on to these a long time, waiting for you to get back.
So this is an early release, we're going to have this podcast in Austin for the entirety of the Paxton impeachment trial. You can watch the Paxton impeachment trial on the website, WFAA.com. Mm-hmm. You can watch it stream there.
Or if you have the WFAA Plus app on your TV, on your smart TV, we're doing gavel to gavel there. So you can watch all of it with in-depth analysis as well. And again, of course, Yolitics is going to be live from Austin these next couple of weeks, or who knows, 4 to 6 weeks. We don't know how long this is going to take.
I hope not.
But we're going to be doing the podcast from there as events unfold. And this should be an interesting time. I mean, you know, we're living through history. This is history.
And which way do you think it's going to go?
Nobody knows. Even the most plugged-in insiders.
They don't know.
You heard Matt Makowiak. He's changed all of his calculations just in the last month. Nobody knows which way this thing is going. We don't know where the curveballs are going to be in this, but we know there are going to be some.
I'm sure our listeners have some ideas on which way they want it to go.
Oh, yeah.
Tweet me or X me. What do you say now? X me?
I can't get on with that. I'm waiting for them to change the name back. I'm still calling it Twitter.
So tweet us and tell us which way you think it's going to go. He is at Jason Wheeler TV.
Yep.
And I am at Jason Whiteley. Curious what you think, and then we'll find out which way it goes as this thing starts on Tuesday.
Thanks for listening, as always. And remember, if you prefer to watch your podcasts, just search for Yolitics on YouTube. We have it all there on video, and you can see these lovely two dark, very different beers that we've had.
Maybe
today.
You want to drink your podcast like I'm doing right now. So thanks for listening. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you from Austin.